In those early months of the Great War, the Graves Registration Committee started to receive requests for photos for the first casualties, the regular professional soldiers of the BEF, the British Expeditionary Force, that had fallen, especially in the battle, the First Battle of Ypres in Belgium in the autumn of 1914. Now, those wooden crosses, they were often irregular in shape and surrounded, of course, by the debris of battle. Many of these soldiers were buried not far from where they fell. And then when you look at those photos, they were surrounded by the smashed towns and villages of northern France and Belgium. And sometimes crosses were just a few broken crosses, not really a cemetery at all. Now, when they did establish proper cemeteries, the burial parties would place a small brass plaque where they buried these men because they worried that the location would be lost. And of course, we know that it often was by the end of the war. When the formal wooden crosses were put in place, what they did was put in printed zinc strips, which recorded the details of the individual burials. Now, back home in the UK, the families, they must have been really shocked by the scale of these casualties. It really wasn't what they expected. Of course it wasn't. Many of these men had served for several years, travelling the world and serving in far-off places like India and even China. And apart from disease, casualties were few and far between. And then they come home, they're mobilised, and they go off across the ocean, cheered off by their folks and friends as they line the streets of their county towns. Suddenly, the people at home discovered that their menfolk had been killed in action, and it must have been a terrible shock to them. Here in Northampton, where I live, the council posted lists of the casualties on the wall outside the Guildhall. Anxious locals pushed and shoved as they tried to look for their men, hoping that they would not be on the list. Telegrams and letters from the War Office had not yet been set up. So within a few weeks of the Great War beginning, the Grave Registration Unit, the GRU, was receiving hundreds of requests for photos of their loved ones' graves. In previous wars, most casualties were buried in mass graves and little, if anything, was recorded. But this time it would be very different. In May 1915, it was decided to set up a photographic department, and three official photographers were recruited. And one of these was a man called Ivan Bawtry. And this podcast, which I call Tales from the Battlefields, it tells Ivan's story and explains what he saw and experienced on the Western Front between 1915 and 1919. And so to help with the narrative, what I've done is post many of his photos that Ivan took on the podcast page of my personal website, which you'll find at www.terrystours.co.uk. Now, Ivan's great-nephew, Jeremy Gordon Smith, he's written a book about the work of Ivan, and he called it Photographing the Fallen. So let's hear from Jeremy now as he starts to explain the story.
Well, thanks very much, Jeremy, for joining us on the podcast Tales from the Battlefields. And for listeners, just so you know, I met Jeremy, getting on for 4 years ago now, when you came along to a Western Front Association meeting, did a fantastic talk on the work of your great-great-uncle. Is that right, great-uncle?
That's right, yes, great-great-uncle, yeah.
But before we go on to Ivan, tell us a bit about yourself. How did you get involved in the interest in the World War One?
My interest probably began around 1991. That was when I went on a school trip to the battlefields. We visited the usual places around Ypres and the Somme, Menin-Gate, of course, Tynecott in the Ypres area, and Thiepval and places like that. Oh, we also went to Vimy Ridge. That's all the fantastic trenches that are...
Tunnels. You went in the Grange Tunnel.
Yes. I don't think we were able to go in the tunnels because of there was lightning and they weren't allowing us
right,
down there.
Right. Health and safety.
But this was it was a fascinating trip. Obviously, I was, as many of us were, very touched or moved.
You're very impressionable, aren't you, when you're that age, a teenager?
Yes, but the huge number of graves that we saw. Mm. And at the time, I don't know how to what extent it's still the same now, but just the huge number of rusted shell cases lying around.
Yeah.
I think there's less of them now, yes. Yeah. But they were all over the place at the time. We went to Hill 60 as well. And
that's been cleaned a lot.
A lot of things. And around that same time, it's the same year that my grandmother died. What that meant was that some more memorabilia that she had came into my dad's possession. And that included two diaries of Uncle Ivan Bawtry. So
Ivan was your great uncle. And was your grandmother?
He's my great-great-uncle, so he would be my grandmother's uncle.
Right, I'm with you. Yep.
My paternal grandmother's uncle.
And when you went on that trip in 1991 with the school, did you know anything about Ivan Bawtry and his work on the Great War?
Yes, I mean, I think I had the diaries just before I went on that trip, and we were studying it at, this would have been GCSE level history. So yeah, we were studying it at school, and I had the diaries, and I took them into school to show my teacher, and my dad took me to the Imperial War Museum to view the photos that were in the that were held in the archive there.
So it developed. So before we go any further, and we better explain to listeners who actually we know is your relative, but who Ivan Bawtry was and what his massive contribution was to the legacy of the Great War. So just give a bit of background about who he was. I know he worked for Kodak, didn't he? That's where he started off.
Yeah, so he was born in 1894. He grew up and lived all of his life in Sutton, in what was Surrey there, now Greater London. He grew up in a fairly well-to-do family. Yeah, by 1913, he was working for a photographic company, which then got bought up by Kodak. So yeah, in 1914, he was working for Kodak. And that was when he had the opportunity to go to the Western Front. So
he didn't join up with the regular army then, did he?
No, he didn't join up with the regular army. No, he didn't. He didn't enlist or feel kind of compelled by the call to volunteer. I think his brother was already involved with the Royal Army Medical Corps. Yep. So I think he felt he was needed at home. His parents were kind of elderly and in need of support. His father. Was blind, so I think he felt needed at home. But in 1915, the Graves Registration Commission that had been newly formed under Fabian Ware had realised that there was a need for photographs. They were getting an increased number of people, bereaved relatives, contacting them, asking them for whatever details they could get.
So this is a very early stage in the war, isn't it? This is in 1915.
1915, we're talking, yes, in the spring, kind of early 1915, this is happening. The commission is receiving requests for photographs. And they're thinking we better set up a photographic department. There's no reason why we can't do that. Let's set up a photographic department to do that. So as a result, looked for, they decided on three professional photographers they were going to need.
Yeah.
They had one chap called Bert Haddon, who was already working with the Red Cross out there and had some experience with photography. And then they hunted for two other people when they got Ivan Bawtry and Frederick Roper, who both had worked for Kodak. Frederick Roper actually had a lot more experience of working in photography. He'd been out in South Africa, and he'd even been a war correspondent with the during the Balkans War in 1912, I think.
Right, okay.
So they joined in. So this photographic department opened around June of 1915. Yeah, less than a year into the war.
Okay, so he's gone out there with his own camera?
No, he was supplied a folding pocket Kodak number 3A.
Yeah.
Which takes postcard size photos. This is a standard camera that the photographers were all given.
Yeah.
It takes roll film, about 10 exposures per film. So it's quite an easy camera to use.
Yeah.
Not too big, not bulky. It folds up, easy to carry around. And they used it with a wooden tripod so that they use it with a tripod so that they could increase the, reduce the aperture to increase depth of field.
Right, I'm with you. Get more panoramic.
Which means a slower shutter speed.
Okay. And he was actually working for Fabian Ware's unit then?
Yes. So Fabian Ware had a mobile unit, which he'd started in the autumn of 1914, originally to collect wounded or help wounded.
Part of the Red Cross, wasn't it, at that stage?
Yeah, it was related to the Red Cross. I mean, he was wanting to do his bit. He got together some different ambulances and other vehicles and just patched together a unit to help evacuate wounded soldiers. I think he ended up helping more French than he did English. But he noticed that there was no adequate method of recording the graves of the dead, of registering who had died and where.
Yeah, that was the
where was the body actually? Because there were lots of isolated graves popping up here and there.
Yeah.
So he decided that this was a need that he was going to fill. That's in a nutshell how he got going.
Yeah. And then Ivan is following the battles, I suppose, really, isn't he? He's got a list of graves that he's been asked to take a photograph of initially.
He's given a... The requests come in and he's told, oh, let's go and photograph these specific graves. Now, he's based largely in the Ypres area and the rear areas, kind of basically the zone north of Arras.
Yes, well, that was at that stage, that was where the British Army, we hadn't gone down as far as the Somme, I don't think, at that stage. We gradually...
I mean, there were the photographers were assigned different areas. So
right.
Ivan had the more kind of areas around Ypres, Bayeux, Béthune.
Well, at this point, we need to give a plug to your book, Jeremy. The Photograph in the Fallen, a War Graves Photographer on the Western Front, 1915 to 1919. And it's a book that you wrote a few years ago. That if you do get a chance to buy this book, then do so. Because so many of the images that we're talking about, especially around Ypres, are contained in the book with a wonderful narrative and lots of individual stories, which is what people are really interested in. So people really do need to buy that book if they get the chance. And you said, you mentioned to me, you think you might be doing another one at some stage.
Yes. Well, I've already done a second book, which is based on Ivan's sister, Viola, her diaries, which she's got a wonderful archive that covers both the First and the Second World War, in particular, the Blitz of 1940-41.
Oh, right. That's a good one. So this will be the third one then.
Yeah. So in the Great War, there's the shortages going on. She talks about conscription, but you've got the Zeppelin air raids and things like that.
So that's
the second book. But the third book, the other book that you allude to is, potentially one about Ypres itself, because Ivan took so many photos of Ypres in 1919 showing the state.
And they really are incredible, aren't they, those photos?
Yes, they really show what happened, in terms of rebuilding and refugees coming back.
Well, I think I'm just looking in your book now, Jeremy, and I think I was looking through it again last night, and the images that really get to me are the ones where you've taken Ivan's images, then you've taken a photograph of, say, the Lille Gate yourself when you visited the battlefields 100 years later. And then, I don't know how you say this technically, you've merged the two photos together.
I have, yes.
Their images.
Yes. I had to go to the same, try and get the same photo, hold up Ivan's photo on a tablet. And
is that how you did it?
Try and aim my camera to try and get more or less the same angle.
Oh, I thought you'd use some kind of technology or software to merge it into the two.
Well, I did. That's the first stage.
Yeah.
Is to get us a photo
to line it up.
Get my own photo that will work with Ivan's photo, and then I used Photoshop.
Photoshop, right? Yeah, that's the software.
Yes. So
I think my favourite one
here. Two photos together.
The Lille Gate here. That answers a few questions that I've got in my head, the photograph of the Lille Gate on page 250, because it shows it's taken from just outside the Lille Gate, looking back into the city.
Right.
And on the left-hand side, it shows the ramparts close to where the cemetery is there, the Rampart Cemetery. And you can see all the shell holes in the wall. And there's Ivan in the sidecar. He's actually in the sidecar, I think, isn't he?
In the
photograph, and someone else is riding the motorbike, and that's how he got around, wasn't it, on this motorbike with the sidecar?
He did after the armistice. Yes, he was given this motorbike with the sidecar, and the driver Griffith. He wasn't too happy actually. He was going to have the driver.
No, he doesn't look too happy in the photo.
He thought the chap would get in the way.
Yes.
However, if you look, you'll see other photos where they're stuck in mud, and I think he's probably quite pleased that driver Griffith was there to help push the bike out of the muddy water.
And then these images and the text around it, it really gives us a good idea of what was going on in Ypres. And this is why you've got to do another book on this, because there's so much more to tell. It tells us what's going on in Ypres in the year after the war.
Yes.
Not so much in the clearance of the battlefields, but in this section of the book, there's a wonderful photo here of the Graves Registration Unit, the football team. And they've got a ball there with Ypres 1919 written on it. There's a tug of war going on, and there's two blokes sitting in the rubble in Ypres with a big smile on their face, with a great big unexploded shell sitting between them.
Yes. So Ivan was able to wander around Ypres taking photographs of all sorts of things. There's a sports day you've just alluded to there.
Yeah.
But there are also lots of soldiers still wandering around, most of them probably to do with Labour Corps have been dropped into the Labour Corps from other units. As soon as they saw Ivan with his camera, they were like, oh, come on, mate, can you take a photo of us? And Ivan was only too happy to oblige. And so he took a number of group photos of different groups of servicemen around the city. And they're all kind of posed photos taken amongst rubble or other places.
The one I particularly, well, there's two here that are really good. It shows Whitsun Monday, 1919, And there's some smartly dressed civilians with umbrellas up, and it's not raining, so that shows it was a hot day. And yep. they're standing in the Groat Market in Ypres, and they're looking at the Cloth Hall and St. Martin's yep. Cathedral, which is not just rubble, it's not just in ruins, but the rubble is taller. It's probably about 20 feet high, isn't it, the rubble? It's much higher than what the humans are and the horses are. And then there's three or four soldiers standing there watching these civilians, wondering what they're thinking. And then below that, we've got some German prisoners of war that have formed a band, and they're playing the violin, being watched by the British Tommies.
Yes. Yeah, yeah. That was all on Whit Month, same day, I think, which yes. Ivan described as a day for glorious weather. So he was out and about photographing whatever he could. The same day was the sports day.
Yeah.
So there was a lot of merriment going on.
Yeah, you can see that. Yeah,
women definitely. With their umbrellas, I think, are tourists. So there's a lot.
Definitely.
Of...
Oh, yeah, they're definitely tourists because they're dressed in civilian clothes. The men are in suits.
Yeah.
You know, they're in their Sunday best, aren't they?
You've got tourists flooding the area. You've got, of course, you've got servicemen who are still yet to be demobbed, who are still in the area, and others. So you can have workmen and all sorts of other people coming into Ypres at that point.
So going back into 1915, 16, 17, I started asking you this question earlier, but then I interrupted your answer. Did he actually get close enough to the fighting to be in danger at all?
Certainly, yeah. He wasn't in the front line.
No.
But you didn't need to be in the front line to be in danger, but just because of the prolific nature of artillery fire and how far-reaching that was.
Yes.
So he would be going to cemeteries that had, you know, varying distances from the front line. But some of the cemeteries he would go to, such as Bedford House, railway dugouts, were really not very far from the front line and frequently were hit by shell fire. You can see in some of his photos, you can see grave markers, the wooden crosses have been damaged by bits missing caused by shrapnel. You can see shell holes. There's a photo, got photos from both those cemeteries where you can see shell holes. And in his diaries, he talks about having to kind of run for cover, avoid shell splinters, and certain cemeteries being too lively for photography, as he would say. So absolutely, yes, there was the risk of artillery fire was very real. He had some narrow escapes on occasion.
Right, so let's stop there for a minute. Let's look at this in more detail using Jeremy's book. And what he's done with his research, he's established that not only was it dangerous, there was one fatal casualty, and that was a man called Captain John Doran MacDonald. And he was wounded by shell fire whilst erecting crosses on the Menin Road, and he died of his wounds on the 18th of March 1916. And there was a Corporal Reginald Bryan, who was a clerk with the GRC, and he described what MacDonald was like. He says, "The officer in charge of our section was Captain MacDonald, a very nice gentleman, but rather too risky in going up the line. Eventually, early in 1916, he was killed by a stray piece of shrapnel whilst he was watching a bombardment on the Ypres to Menin Road. On many occasions, he would go out into the front line trenches in order to put a cross on a grave or to see a chaplain, and he had many escapes in his car from shells and snipers, but unfortunately, he paid the penalty in the end." Now, Brian himself also wrote an account of what it was like to be under fire whilst visiting these cemeteries. And he wrote this account, dated the 26th of August 1915, in Plug Street Wood, which, as you probably know, is south of Ypres. "We could hear the guns going off and see the smoke of the shells bursting in the wood. We turned off at the church to the left down a long straight road with tall trees on both sides. Evidently, their observation balloons must have sighted the car, as two or three shells came over in front of us. As we wanted to go to a place called Hyde Park Corner, my officer decided to go on, but when we arrived, we found it becoming very hot. We could hear the shells bursting somewhere in the wood, and a staff officer told us we'd better clear out whilst we were safe. As shells were bursting on the road we had just come, we simply had to make a dash through the wood. The old motor car went along like a thing alive, and all the time we could hear the boom of the shells and the shrilly whistle. When the Tommies heard a shell, they all dashed into their dugouts or behind shelter, and even then it struck me as being rather comical to see them skelter like a load of rabbits. But evidently they knew more of the danger of shrapnel than I did. After several minutes of scorching, however, we managed to clear the wood and get into comparative safety." And of course, if you go to Plug Street Wood, he mentioned a position there called Hyde Park Corner, where there is a cemetery there, Commonwealth War Graves Commission Cemetery, and that's opposite the Plug Street Memorial to the Missing.
Now, Ivan himself, as Jeremy said, he mentioned in his diary a few incidents where enemy attention got a bit close to comfort. And it seemed that Ivan himself was not averse to a bit of danger. And this is a quote from his diary. One day in a cemetery at Vormizela, I was taking a picture just in front of a naval 6-inch gun and was so busy I did not realise they were going to fire. As they fired, I and the camera bounced in the air. If shelling got too heavy, the officer would withdraw us. One day he very nearly got hit and was bowled over while we hid behind a tree to dodge the shell splinters. Another time at Dickybush, I and the officer stood talking at his dugout entrance. He said quite casually, I think it would be a good idea to move from here, as Jerry has his balloons up and may think we will be a suitable target. We just started to move off when we heard the thud of one of his long-range guns and the whiz of a shell approaching. We threw ourselves down and got a shower of earth and things all over us, but nobody was hurt. Where we had been standing at the dugout entrance was a big shell hole. It made us think that did. Kemmel was a place often visited where the cemetery was close to a howitzer battery of 9.2-inch guns, making an awe-inspiring din and attracting enemy attention from time to time. Being near a battery, enemy aircraft went over, observing, and we were ordered to stand perfectly still when a warning whistle sounded and never to look up until the all-clear whistle sounded. He then goes on to say that some of the cemeteries around Ypres were pretty lively, such as railway dugouts and spoil bank near Hill 60 and Essex Farm. I had a special photo request for that cemetery one day, and the officer I was with said it was too lively for photography. However, not wishing to fail, I went by myself and took the photo. I rather think this incident and others like it resulted in me being mentioned in dispatches. Things got more and more lively as time went on. So back to my interview, my chat with Jeremy, and we started to talk about what the cemeteries must have looked like when he was there.
And everyone who's been to the Western Front is very familiar with the beautiful layout and the Portland headstones that we see now. But of course, when he's there during the war, we've got lots of temporary cemeteries before they'd been concentrated after the war. And even in the photos he's taken in 1919, the cemeteries look very different to the way they look today, don't they? Places like Tynecott and Hoog. Can you just describe to everybody what they look like at that stage?
What they looked like back then?
Yeah, when he was there.
Well, yes, he would have seen rows and rows of wooden crosses of all types of shapes and sizes.
Yeah.
And colours. Some would have been painted, some not painted.
Because we only see them in black and white, of course, don't we? We don't see what he's.
Yes,
in colour.
A lot of them were painted white, actually, and you see quite a lot of white crosses. Or some were tarred and a more kind of black colour, some much more elaborate than others. So some cemeteries are more orderly than others, whereas others you would find a bit higgledy-piggledy, bit ramshackle. And of course, if there's been shell fire, you'll find bits of cross lying around all over the place. And
like Maple Copse is a good example of that.
Maple Copse is a good example of that. And with all the shell holes and the mud getting churned up, a lot of these, there's a lot of water about as well. So he would have been, sometimes he was wading through large amounts of water to try and get a photo. Sometimes he just couldn't get an adequate photo. And they did have some quality control over to what was acceptable to send to a relative. Sometimes to take the photo he wanted, he might have to do a bit of gardening or a bit of kind of just grab a bit of turf, position it and try and make the grave look a bit more acceptable. And it might be a complete carnage all around it with shell holes, large amounts of water and mud. And
but I think look, what I see in the pictures, particularly around Hoog on the Menin Road, the Hoog Crater Cemetery there, is large numbers of unexploded shells, which they've had to clear out of the battlefield, haven't they, to create these concentration cemeteries. And that's what he's seen, isn't it? He's seen these massive piles of shells. And after the war, when he's there after the war, and he's followed the Graves Registration Unit, he's seen dead bodies being recovered, hasn't he?
He does, yes. So, I mean, he was specifically asked to go, this was in 1920, actually, and he's asked to go back.
So he's gone home in 1919 and then come back again.
Yeah, he was demobbed in October of 1919. And then he comes back in 1920 with a specific commission to photograph what is happening in respect of the cemeteries and other activities such as the recovery of remains from the battlefields. And he takes a series of photos, which are probably the most powerful photos that you'll find of this nature, taken in April 1920 from the Passchendaele battlefields of basically labour units, graves registration units, remains from the battlefield, remains that may have been lying
very
there.
Very graphic, aren't they, some of the photos?
They are, yes. It's very unpleasant, extremely unpleasant work, but it had to be done.
Had to be done, yeah. And we certainly, families even today, are very glad that that work was done, doesn't it? Because, it gives us somewhere to visit. They really are incredible. And the other thing, there was two other things to do with the Somme. I know you've mentioned that most of his work took place up in Ypres. There's on page 111 of the book, he talks about German cemeteries. And I just wanted to quote a bit. He's talking about being up in Ypres on a Menin Road. And he says, "We searched a bit, discovered a large German cemetery. This had been kept beautifully with paths and flowers of all descriptions. We found several British graves." Then underlined, he says, "These were treated in every way the same as their own men. Good wooden crosses with inscriptions properly painted and just the same arrangement of flowers. You see, the Hun is not a Hun in every respect." That's what he's written.
Yeah.
And that's dated October 1918 in a letter to his mum. So this is while the war is still going on.
It is. By that point, the Germans have been pushed back out of the salient. So he was able to reach cemeteries that he would not otherwise have been able to get.
And that's only just happened, of course. That had only just happened.
Yes, the fact that he's got to a German, he's actually got reached a German cemetery, just shows how where the line has moved, coming up against. So he's managing to get beyond places like Morslader, which is beyond Passchendaele.
Yeah, over
getting
the
down
top
the Menin Road. So yeah, I don't know which cemetery exactly. It doesn't tell us.
No,
exactly
it doesn't.
Where
no, but
we
what
just
he
know
does...
that he was heading down the Menin Road when he found it. So.
Yes, that's right, up towards Gulliver. But then he's taken one of the few photographs that I've ever seen of a German cemetery. And this one is taken at Bazentin on the Somme. Yep. And it's the only one that's it's the only one. So the likelihood...
The only one I know of that he took, in his collection. Of
we know that most of the graves, German graves that are on the Somme, were then concentrated at Fricourt, which is just a few miles away. But again, it's an incredible photo. It shows, in the background, you've got Bazentin wood there. You can see where that was. And at that stage, it's just tree stumps, isn't it? And
absolutely.
You can see the chalk.
Cemeteries
are
flanked by tree stumps.
And, you can place that now. I think there's a Commonwealth War Graves Commission cemetery exactly where that German cemetery was then in the village. I think that's on that location.
There is one, Bazentin Le Petit or something.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, in the village
called,
there. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the only one that I know of that Ivan photographed while he was visiting the Somme. And again, that he would have been visiting the Somme, must have been in 1920. When
1920,
he was...
I think it's those words those words make that photo powerful. The words that he said about how the Germans have treated our graves with respect, and then we can see in that photo, that we've done the same with the Germans.
So using Jeremy's book, again, I'd like to have a closer look at what some of these cemeteries look like in 1917. And these words come from one of the distinguished architects who designed so many of the cemeteries and, of course, the cenotaph in Whitehall. And that was Sir Edwin Lutyens. And he visited the battlefields in 1917, in the summer of 1917, and he wrote a letter home to his wife. And this is what he saw. He said, "The cemeteries, the dotted graves, are pathetic. Especially one thinks how things are run and problems treated at home. What humanity can endure, suffer, is beyond belief. The battlefields, the obliteration of all human endeavour, achievement, and the human achievement of destruction, is bettered by poppies and wild flowers. They are friendly to an unexploded shell as they are to the leg of a garden seat in Surrey. One is seen very little of all there is to be seen. We are not allowed very near the front. But that little is ominous of what lies behind. A battlefield with blurred trenches, the position of a machine gun marked by its litter of spent cartridges, the ruined tanks, the rough, broken, shell-holed, pitted ground you assume was once a village, where a small bit of wall of what once was a church may stand, but nothing else. The half-ruined places are more impressive, for then you can picture what a place might have been. The graveyards, haphazard from the needs of so much to do, and little time for thought, and then a ribbon of isolated graves, like a Milky Way across miles of country, where men were tucked in as they fell. Ribbons of little crosses, each touching each across a cemetery, set in the wilderness of annals, and where one sort of flower has grown, the effect is charming, easy, and oh, so pathetic. and one thinks no other monument is needed. For miles these graves occur, from single graves to a close-packed areas of thousands, on every sort of site and in every sort of position. The bodies laid to face the enemy, in some places so close one wonders how to arrange their names in decent order. Now, this, of course, as we said, was 1917, and you wonder with what Luchin saw during his visit, awful summer. Maybe that inspired him to design so many of his cemeteries in such splendid fashion that we see today, the visitors of today, when we go and see those splendid cemeteries, it really is impossible to compare with what not just Luchin's but everyone else was seeing all those years ago. So let's get back to the interview with Jeremy, and we look in more detail at what Ivan did after the armistice, after the war, and into his later life.
What happened then? 1920 is his final visit to the Western Front, and he goes home. What happens to his life then? He's involved in the Second World War.
Well, when he comes back initially in 1919, he goes straight back to his job at Kodak. So, yeah, I mean, when he returns in 1920 to the Western Front, he's effectively a civilian.
Civilian, yeah.
He's no longer... There are photos of him out there, like one of him in a Vauxhall car. You'll notice he's not wearing his Royal Engineers uniform anymore.
He's in civilian clothing, yeah.
He's in his civvies, yeah. So he's back working at Kodak, and he's back running helping his brother to run the Boys' Life Brigade.
Right.
This then becomes the, in 1926, merges with the Boys' Brigade. Brother Athol has started a photographic business and can't continue. So Ivan takes up the captaincy of the first Belmont company, Belmont being part of Sutton, or just near to Sutton in Surrey, near where they live. So he takes over the captaincy of that and is captain of that right up into the 1960s or 70s. And
his house is bombed, is it, in the Second World War?
So in the Second World War, he's still working for Kodak, but they move their offices. So he was in central London, I think, in Holborn. Then they moved to Harrow, which then was considered outside of London, not so now, I suppose. But he moved there and continued running Boys' Brigade meetings up that way. Bombs, of course, were falling in Sutton, and the family were frequently finding themselves sheltering in the cellar. So Ivan would have to keep going down into the cellar with his sisters. So he's living, when he was living in Sutton, he was there with his sister Viola, Elaine and Sylvia, and a German Jewish refugee.
Oh, really?
Julius Astenheim, who had been taken in by the family in 1939.
Right, he got out just in time.
Yes, he had fled from Frankfurt. And they would often find themselves hunkering down in the cellar. Now, the house never got hit, but in 1944, it was damaged by a flying bomb, which landed about 300 or 400 yards away, but that was anything that was within, I don't know how much, 500 or maybe more yards of this bomb would have had their windows blown out.
That must have been terrifying, mustn't it?
Yeah. Viola records this, doesn't give details of the actual blast particularly, only that one happened, but she just talks about the glass being everywhere and damaging her flowers in the garden. She tries to be quite optimistic and say, well, the windows were so dirty, now I can see out. But yeah, that was the closest they came. But of course, for Ivan, being stuck in the cellar would have reminded him of what he went through in the First World War. He spent many a time in a cellar. Often he had his dark rooms in a cellar.
Oh, I was going to ask you, how he actually developed the photos. So he developed them out there, did he?
Yeah, so initially he and Haddon and Roper would be taking their photos and then developing their own photos, or they might be helping each other. They would have dark rooms set up. In 1915, they actually made one out of ground sheets in the grounds of Chateau de Relange, or Relange, I'm not sure how to pronounce that, in Lille, France.
Yeah.
And then when they moved to a place called Chateau de Valfosse, they had wooden huts set up outside the chateau, which they used as dark rooms. Later on, they changed the way of doing things and had a dedicated kind of processing unit in Boulogne, where Haddon went to Boulogne to take charge of that. So all the films were just sent over to Haddon's unit in Boulogne, where everything was developed there.
Yeah. And then there's a fascinating letter, just looking in the book again, dated 1941, October 1941, which is during the Second World War. And it's actually from Fabian Weir himself to
it is, yeah.
Ivan, you know, thanking him for the work that he did in the First World War. But it's he thanks him personally for the help you've given me and how glad I am to be in touch with you again after so many years. And then he goes on to say, I think that neither of us could have imagined that we should ever again be concerned in this sad task.
Right.
And that's showing us that, you know, the two worlds have overlapped. And then he retires. You said he retires from Kodak in 1953. And
yeah, the end of
never married. Yeah. Said he never got married.
No, he didn't, no.
And then he's awarded the MBE. How did that come about?
Yeah, that's for his services with the Boys Brigade. So
was it? Nothing to do with the war then?
No, nothing to do with the war. Yes, I mean, he was awarded that in 1977, so a bit later, but it was for the war. So this was, by that point, he would have captain for, what, 50 years?
Yeah, and that's only a couple of years before he died in 1979?
Yes, it's only a couple of years before he died. But yeah, he was much loved, and people still remember him. So
bet they do.
I post stuff about him occasionally on a Sutton History Facebook group, and every sort of people come out of the woodwork who remember Cap Bawtry. They call him Cap.
Oh, really?
I was in the Boys Brigade in the 1960s, and I remember Cap. People always seem to remember him quite affectionately, and they remember him having a. People remember him having a motorbike.
Like, oh, really? Motorbike. When he came home, I wonder if it was the same motorbike that he had.
Yes, well, I doubt it was, but it was. people said it was some kind of old motorbike, and they'd see him, and I think it had a sidecar as well.
Oh, really? Oh, brilliant!
Drive this around Sutton, kind of in the 1960s and possibly the 70s. I sadly don't have a photo of this, but
love to have one of those, wouldn't you? So, just to finish, then. How would you sum up his legacy to the Great War? I mean, you know, he didn't have a gun. He was part of the army, but he's obviously left a great legacy. How would you describe
it? Well, he had something more helpful than a gun in terms of remembrance, and that was a camera. So he took, in terms of war graves photos, he took more than 28,000 photographs.
And all these on the Imperial War Graves Commission website, you say, in the Bawtry Collection.
So the Bawtry collection is made up of 600 glass plates that were found in Ivan's cellar, the same cellar where he was hiding from, taking refuge from Nazis.
Yeah, yeah, the Nazis.
The
yeah.
Luftwaffe. These were given to the IWM in the 1970s.
Yeah.
At least there's 600. So most of what Ivan took is lost.
Yeah. Well, he certainly left a wonderful legacy, hasn't he? And, you know, your book does justice to him with a picture there of what was called the Ypres prison cemetery, looking through the broken walls there. It's now the Reservoir Cemetery.
Yes.
And I think we're all historians, we're all very, very grateful for the work that he did. And the photos, especially around Ypres, I've seen lots of museums using those photos, lots of websites. I've seen lots of historians using those photos to show people what it was like there. And without the work that he did, we wouldn't be able to do that. And he was such a young man as well, looking at the colour photo on the front page. He was another young man, wasn't he, at the time?
He was only 21 when he went to the Western Front. So, he would have been, 25 when he left, but 26 in 1920. So, but it's an incredible archive.
And you must feel very proud to be related to him then.
Yes. I mean, I like photography as well. I like history. So it was an absolute pleasure to be able to put this book together.
And you're only a couple of years old, I suppose, when he died. So you haven't really got any memory of him.
No, I mean, the last photograph in the book is me sat on his lap.
That's right. Yeah, it's great.
In 1978, I would have been not quite a year old. But he was talked about, and there are items from his house that
you feel as though you know him, don't you? You do feel as though
Yeah.
So thank you very much for doing that. We'll give a good plug to your book on the website, and we'll speak again soon. And good luck with the exhibition in Ypres.
Thank you, Terry. Yeah.
Thank you. Cheers, Jeremy.
So I hope you enjoyed the interview with Jeremy there, a fascinating character. But please don't go away. We've got a few minutes left in the podcast. So what I wanted to do was to go a bit deeper into this process of recovery and reburial of the missing. And as we know, hundreds of thousands of British and Commonwealth soldiers were missing in action. And it was the job of the graves concentration units, which were made up of the grave registration unit, labour companies and other units. And these were so many men that had stayed on after the war to look for their mates. And they had to carry out what was a hazardous job because there were still unexploded shells like there still are today on the battlefields. But as you can imagine, it was also extremely gruesome when they came across one of the lost soldiers. Now, in Jeremy's book, he quotes a Captain G. Crawford who was with the 68th Labour Company. And they drew up some processes for dealing with the procedure of the graves concentration units. And This is what he wrote. He said, each squad of 32 men should be given an area consisting of a map square of 500 yards, which must be thoroughly searched and cleared. Advantage should be taken of natural features where possible, as it's much easier to search the area between a road and a trench or a line of pillboxes. The men should be posted in extending order at intervals of about 6 yards. They must advance slowly, searching the area thoroughly and avoid bunching. Just reading that, it makes you think that's exactly how they advanced on that day, the 1st of July 1916, the first day of the Battle of the Somme. So if any of those soldiers recovering the bodies had been involved in the Somme 3 or 4 years earlier, it must again have brought back awful memories. The account goes on. Whenever a body is found, a stake is to be planted. Experience only teaches men where bodies will probably be found in graves which are not visible, but the following signs are characteristic. Rifles or posts bearing helmets or equipments placed at the head of graves, remains or equipment upon the surface or protruding from the ground, rat holes. These sometimes will show small bones or pieces of equipment brought to the surface by the rats. Discoloration of grass, earth or water. Grass is often of a vivid bluish green colour where bodies are buried and water turns a greenish black or grey. The area having been thoroughly searched and staked out, the work of the exhumation begins. And this is where it gets really gruesome. It says each party of four should have with them shovels, rubber gloves, canvas and rope, creosote and stretchers. An area must be swept and reswept before it is definitely decided that no graves have been overlooked. In the actual work of exhumation, the men should be warned not to dig too closely to the bodies, but well outside them. Such a precaution renders the work easier, it prevents disturbance of the bodies, and most important of all, it reveals whether more than one man is buried in one particular spot. The body, having been exhumed, is placed upon the canvas and a careful search is made for any effects, which may lead to identification. The pocket should be searched and a special examination made of the neck, wrists and braces where identity ticks, discs, may be found. To me, that really is one of the most horrendous features of all. And I've read this in other accounts as well, that the search parties had to actually look inside the corpses, inside orifices, to look for these identity tags, these identities that may have been hidden away, more damage caused by shell fire, maybe after they'd been killed. The account goes on. All effects are placed in a ration bag and sent to the cemetery attached to the body. When more than one body is found, the remains must be kept and sent to the cemetery together, and the labels so marked that the cemetery officer will bury them side by side. It is often impossible from records to identify unknowns from the fact that they are known to have been buried with the identified men. The remains are wrapped in the canvas, which is tied and labelled. It has been found useful to mark all labels of one group of bodies with a distinctive letter of the alphabet, followed by a number showing the order in which they are to be buried. A Union flag should be provided for each wagon or ambulance to cover the bodies. The notes then go on to describe what happens when the body is buried. The worker transporting the bodies to the cemetery is usually carried out by general service wagons. Motor ambulances are used when parties are working near the main road or to take bodies from the wagons as soon as they reach the main road. Each wagon can take 5 loaded stretchers, 4 on top and 1 on the bottom. A stretcher should be allotted to each body except in the case of fragmentary remains. A spare man should walk behind the wagon when it is loaded with bodies to see that no accident happens on the way to the cemetery. When they arrive at the cemetery, all effects are examined carefully and compared with the labels attached. The size of the digging party depends on the number of bodies expected to be received at each cemetery. The bodies are then placed in their respective positions and the graves filled in either with or without a committal service. Stakes bearing labels giving particulars of the men buried beneath are then erected at the head of the graves until the GRE can erect crosses. It has been found advisable to impress upon the men that the work is of vital importance, having regard to the number of men still missing, many of whom can be found and identified if the work is carefully done. The greater the stress laid upon the need for identification, the greater the interest the men take in their work. Now, the final story that I'd like to talk about on the podcast is really personal. As you know, when I started this podcast and all the way along, I wanted to tell the individual stories of individual soldiers that died in the Great War. And the reason why this story is so personal to this podcast is because at one dreadful moment, Ivan was asked to take the photograph of a grave of his cousin. Edmund Arthur Howe Lilly, who was called Jack, and he'd been killed by shrapnel on the 31st of July 1918. Now, Ivan briefly mentions Jack in his diary, dated August 1917. They met on at least three occasions out on the Western Front, and this is what he wrote about the August 17 meeting. He said, "I met Jack and he came to see me and we spent an hour or two together. He spoke of the hectic life in the trenches and said it couldn't last long. A few months later, he was killed by a shell fire on the Somme and is buried at St. Amand Cemetery." The battalion diary that he was serving with tells us that there was one officer wounded, three other ranks killed, 18 other ranks wounded and two missing. And that one officer was Jack. Ivan received a letter from a friend of his called Oswald Stapley. And he was with Jack that night and he gave him clear details of what exactly happened. "As I wrote and told you, I spoke to your cousin, Mr. Lilly, at Battalion HQ in the line on the 29th. I immediately went round to the trench mortar HQ and there saw some of the fellows, one of whom was with your cousin when he was killed. It seems that on the night of the 31st, our trench mortars were doing some strafing and for that purpose were moved up and came into action on an open road where there was no cover. At 1:30 a.m, Mr. Lilly was standing by one of his guns and two fellows were standing in front of him when a Fritz shell dropped about 20 yards from them. The other two noticed Mr. Lilly fall and bent down to see that a small piece of shrapnel had entered the left side of his head and passed through out of his helmet on the other side, and he was killed instantly. One of his colleagues, a corporal in the same unit, said that Captain Lilly was one of the bravest and best officers in the army, and all the other chaps agreed. He was buried in a little cemetery in a village called St. Amand. There's no need to try and describe the cemetery to you. I'm afraid you know it only too well. It's a quiet spot between an orchard and the French cemetery." And we've got more details about how he died from a second Lieutenant Hardy, who wrote to Jack's mother, and then she wrote herself to Ivan. And it says, "The battery was engaged on special work, and rather than delegate the duty to a junior officer or an NCO, he personally supervised the firing of the guns in order that he might encourage his men in a difficult situation. He went to his duty cheerfully, knowing that he had a difficult task. His men were encouraged by his presence and were heartbroken by his death. He suffered no pain as his death was absolutely instantaneous, and his death is regretted by both officers and men of the battery, who realised they'd not only lost a good commanding officer, but a true and loyal friend. Will you please accept my heartfelt sympathy for the loss of my dear friend and your son?" Now, I don't know about you, but I often wonder what it must have been like to be at home when that letter or telegram came through the door of the wife or the mother or other family members telling them the awful news from the front that their loved one had died. And in this case, Jack's wife was called Annie, and she received the telegram 4 days after his death. Now, Ivan's had a sister called Viola, and she was very fond of her cousin Jack. And in her diaries, it reveals that she had strong feelings for him, and she had an awful, profound sense of loss and grief that she talks about in her diary. She said, "Father came to the back door and called me, and wonderingly I answered him. He said nervously, 'Viola, there's very bad news from Jack.' As he paused, I said, 'Yes,' thinking if the news had come from Jack, he was wounded or ill. Father continued, 'As you might have expected, he's been killed, leading a trench mortar battery.' In an indifferent sort of voice, as if listening to uninterested news, I said, 'Oh,' and Father added the remark that Aunt Minnie was upstairs in hysterics, and then he went back to the dining room. All through the morning, I carried on with work in the same stunned sort of way, not allowing myself to think, and perfectly dry-eyed. As I was peeling potatoes, Aunt Polly came up to me and said something about, 'Isn't it awful about poor Jack?' and some other words about me being good to him. I answered in the same indifferent tone. I forget if she kissed me. Sylvia and Father went to church. I went and picked all the violas, a job I'd been meaning to do for some days. As I carried a bowlful into the breakfast room, Mother came down and followed me in and kissed me without saying a word. That was better and made my eyes just moisten. She also went to church. Later, Aunt Millie came out of the kitchen with a cup and saucer, her face swollen with crying. She said, "Oh, Viola, what are we going to do?" I put my arm around her neck and kissed her again and again, but said no word. She went away weeping, and just for a moment my own tears fell. She said, "I walked down to the church this morning alone with Father and was somewhat cheered by his belief that the dead are not sleeping, but are quite near us." She then quotes the words of the poet Tennyson, "Those we love are taken first. God gives us love, something to love he lends us. But when love is grown to ripeness, that on which it throws falls off and love is left alone." The following day, August the 5th, her diary entry is just a few words. "Jack, I can't bear it," she says. August the 7th, "Feel worse than ever and can't stop crying at certain thoughts. I put all his letters together in a wooden box and started painting it mauve." August the 11th, "Took Father to church, was able to talk of things a bit and again some comfort." August the 16th, "Felt better at first, but a few of Jack's things arrived by second post and I'm down again." August the 27th, "The GR people wrote to say that Jack is buried in St Omen Cemetery in Doulons." Now, later that year, of course, the armistice comes on the 11th of November, and the day before, her diary entry says, "He is with me, I know it. One day I shall realise his presence. We are still together, sharing in everything. The hellish nightmare of war is nearly over." And then in November 18th of November, it is 1919, sorry, she goes to London to the Cenotaph with a Mr. and Mrs. Lawrence, and their son had also been killed. He was one of Jack's pals, and he'd been killed in June of 1918. And she says, "I like them very much, especially Mrs. Lawrence. She and I walked together and talked of her boy and of Jack. We had first sight of the cenotaph, and Mrs. Lawrence cried." Of course, that would have been the temporary cenotaph that was erected shortly after the war and was replaced by the permanent cenotaph that we see today and was unveiled by King George V on Armistice Day, 1920. So there you go, some more extraordinary tales from the battlefields. We keep uncovering them. It's always incredible to talk to these people with their stories and their relatives telling us what went on all those years ago. So I hope you've enjoyed this one. Thanks very much again for tuning in. When this podcast is released, I'll actually be on the Somme in France, on the Somme battlefields, with a couple of other guides that work for Ledger, Ian Mason and Andrew Thornton, and a few other guys as well. And we're going to be looking for more stories to tell from the front line. And hopefully we're going to be recording some pieces for the podcast whilst we're out there. So that podcast will be released in a few days' time, maybe about 10 days' time. Until then, we'll sign off in the usual way, playing the last post in memory of all of the soldiers that Ivan Bawtry photographed, and in particular his cousin Jack Lilly.